Okay, kids, I've got a few questions for you. I still have to get rid of a few of these candy bars. So, first, let's do this. In the book of Revelation, one of the churches is rebuked for not being neither hot nor cold, but lukewarm. Any kids here know which church? All right, it was Laodicea. We'll try another one. Got to start with a hard one to make sure. What prophet married a prostitute named Gomer and then kept on going after her? She kept leaving him and he kept forgiving her. You kids don't know that either. Boy, we need to get you in Sunday school. All right. Somebody just handed me this right before we started. That's why I don't have this already at the beginning. All right. Who's the first kid who can stand up and name four apostles? That's pretty close, but not quite. Some of those weren't apostles. So keep trying. You know any others? All right, who else? Go ahead, stand up. Not quite. She said Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, but some people who wrote Gospels aren't necessarily apostles. Oh, you're going to say. Just think of the 12 disciples. You know, John was one. Who else? And somebody said Matthew. Matthew's one. So you need, who can say two others? Wow. These are, I need to find easier questions. Back here.
Peter,
very good. See, now that was, we were having so much trouble, that's worth one right there. Can you get it? Heads up. Incoming. All right. Who was the first king of Israel? Just say it if you know it. Who said it? Who's the second king?
David.
Where's that? Okay. You watching this time? Who's the second king? Who said that? Good. All right. And then after that, there was never any kings who were over the whole nation of Israel. Why is that? What happened to the nation of Israel after Solomon? So what? Broke up into... That's right. Split in the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. All right. Do you want a candy bar? All right. One last thing. The Bible drill. You kids get your Bibles? You ready? First person to open their Bible, first kid to open their Bible to Revelation 3:5. Just start reading it as soon as you find it. Stand up. Heads up. All right. Okay. We'll dismiss the kids now. Kids, you can go on ahead and go on up to your Sunday school classes, and then we'll have our class down here. Good job. I'll pick some better questions next time. Okay, go to your class. All right. We are in part 12 of our class on discernment, section 3, the first section of this class. We studied about how to have sound reasoning, and we talked about and so on. Second section, we talked about what are the fundamental essentials of the gospel, and we summarized that, and that summary has been on your notes every single week. Because now in the third phase, what we're doing is we're looking at all the false religions, and we're seeing where they depart from the essentials. So now we looked last time at Hinduism, and all we had time to do last time was discuss what the religion of Hinduism is like. What I'd like to do now is do a little role play, where you as a class are going to meet me. I'm into some sort of a Hinduism, and what you need to do is ask me questions to find out what I believe and where I stand with regard to the essentials and where I stand with regard to you, if we agree on anything or disagree. This isn't a time where you're going to be trying to present the gospel to me or persuade me of anything. Right now you're just gathering information. So go ahead and start asking me questions, and I'll tell you what I believe. As soon as I die, the question is, what will happen to me when I die? When I die, I will come back. I'll be reincarnated into another person, and it'll be a good condition or bad condition based on my life and how devout I am in this life. Who decides? Boy, that's a good question. I guess the gods are. I'm not sure. Maybe it happens. It's just part of the forces of nature that just determine it without somebody making a conscious decision. Well, my goal is to be reincarnated at a higher level so that I can keep working up and someday reach a level that is of complete enlightenment and as I come back in a better form, then I'll make progress towards that goal. I don't know. I don't know.
And how do you know if you're doing a good job right now?
I don't know.
But you have control of your life and you're doing good even though you don't know what you're doing.
Right. No, I don't think so. I just try to help them along and teach them and enlighten them.
What is your authority for knowing what is good and what isn't?
Well, the scriptures and my conscience and the writings of great people of the past. You know.
And if some of those
if some of those contradict each other, how do I know which way to go? I guess I just have to let my conscience be my guide.
Like Pinocchio?
Yeah, like Pinocchio.
Your conscience
Well, for me,
is your conscience ever flawed, do you think, or can it pretty much depend on being correct all the time?
Is my conscience the measure of truth? For me, it is. But is it flawed, or is it always true? Is it always right? For me, it's always right.
What is the end reward that you're seeking, and how do you know if you will receive it?
Well, I don't know for sure that I'll receive it. It's just something that I work towards, and it's not all that. It's not the only thing that matters whether or not I receive it, because the crucial thing is the path, the journey, you know. And I just am trying to make the journey along the best I can. Okay, that's good enough. As much as I can take. Those are hard questions. I don't know how these unbelievers answer these questions. Actually, you know, it's tough to know what they think. They probably don't know. I mean, I'm sure a lot of them haven't thought about some of that stuff. But okay, now that we've established, you're talking to somebody that really hasn't thought through that much of what he believes. He's got some obvious contradictions in what he believes. Now you have to come up with an approach. Now, look at your sheet in the essentials. Try and figure. Now, you didn't ask me much about what I believe about God, about Jesus. You mostly focused on the issue of sin and the goal, my ultimate goal, which is okay. But what strategies? We're not going to role play this. We're just going to suggest. Does anybody have a suggestion? What kind of a strategy would you think might be a way to begin to reach this person with the gospel? Where would you start? Is there any point of commonality that you could establish?
There's something beyond death.
Okay, is there something beyond it? There is some goal beyond death. That's the point of commonality.
A desire to do right.
Okay. All right, a desire to do right.
An acknowledgement that you're not perfect.
Okay. All right, let's start there. Desire to do right and acknowledging you're not perfect. There's some problem of conscience of sin. There's some sense that I need to be changed. I believe that. You believe that. I mean, we agree there. You can talk to me about that, and I'll just agree with what you say, you know, to a point. And so what about that as a strategy? That's actually the first kind of strategy I would think to. I think that's really our point of commonality with anybody, no matter how bizarre the religion. Everyone knows deep down that they've got evil inside them, that they do things that are wrong, and think things and say things that are wrong. And some religions have taught the people to deny that, to pretend that it's not true. But you can suppress that truth. You can't do away with it. It's always there. And so I think that's a great way to start with just about anybody, is start talking about that. What would be a good way to do it? Any thoughts on the best way to go about doing that? There's some more outlines. Somebody else needs some more outlines. So approach number one is address the problem of sin. Not a very good marker anymore, is it? One way you could do this is just simply start talking about the fact that get them to agree more and more on the depth of their sin. Most people understand that they have some evil, they have some sin. Their problem is they don't realize near the depth and the problem of it. So you can say things like, you know, what I believe, what my scriptures teach is that man has a problem with being sinful. We're not perfectly holy. We're not perfectly righteous. You agree with that, right? Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Well, I mean, it's really, really a problem. I mean, the more I think about it, the more I realize, you think about how many times, you know, that you've done something, and I've done something that I shouldn't have done, thought something I shouldn't have thought, said something I shouldn't have said, failed to do some good thing that I knew I should do, and I failed to do it. Times when I did the right thing, but my motives were mixed. Times when I was selfish. Times when I was inconsiderate. I mean, you add all that up, and what an offense. So now, what what do you believe we do? I mean, to me, that's the major consideration, is how can I be forgiven? How can I be cleansed from all that? Just because I do good works in the future doesn't cancel out the fact that I've done all these bad things. Plus, I know I'm going to do more bad things in the future. What can I do about that problem? What does your religion all have to offer as far as cleansing all the sin of the past and so on? Let me tell you what I believe about that. This is why I believe in Christianity, because to me, it's the only religion I've ever seen that even addresses how to cleanse my sin of the past, the present, and the future. So that's one approach. How about the approach of, look at your list of essentials, where it begins. The nature of God. Now here, this is the opposite approach. The first approach, you establish a point of commonality and you go from there. This approach is the opposite of that. You find the part where you're just diametrically opposed. This guy doesn't have a clue what the God you believe in is like. He believes in many gods. He believes that the many gods are imperfect. He believes that no one God is totally supreme. All that kind of thing. And you're going to come along and introduce him to a radical new concept. And so you can just say, let me just proclaim something to you. And this may not sound like a very good strategy, but you have to understand that the gospel has power. There's power in the truth. And you never have to apologize. You never have to earn the right to share the truth. I've heard people say that. It's never true. You have the right. You've been given the right as a Christian to proclaim the truth anytime. And so you can just go to the person and say, look, let me tell you what the Bible says. Jesus Christ died and raised himself from the dead. That's why I think he has authority. And here's what he taught. He taught about a God who is a supreme. One single God. He said there's only one single God. And that God is supreme. He's the God that made everything. He's perfect. Everything he does is perfect. He's perfectly loving. He's kind and gentle. He's perfectly just. He's perfectly holy. He hates sin. And you just go through and just describe the essentials of what God is like. And just introduce them to that concept. Or, third approach, you can begin to proclaim Christ. And talk about history. To say, you know, historically, we know there was a man. He lived. He was sinless. He did miracles. He did miracles like nobody's ever done. He died, and historically we can demonstrate and prove that he rose from the dead. I was talking to a new believer just recently who... I mentioned that there's historical evidence for the resurrection. She was shocked. She's a believer. She had no idea that we can demonstrate historically that Jesus rose from the dead. That's a great place to just say, you know, you can just start right, you know, with history. Say, look, he rose from the dead. What are we going to do with that? And the fact that he did that gives him authority. And here's what he said. He said that he was God in human flesh, and that he died on our behalf to pay the penalty that we owed, and that only through faith in him can a person know God. And we, you know, have to come to grips with that. Either we have to believe what he said, or we have to somehow explain how can he do all these miracles and raise himself from the dead when he's not really who he said he is. And so you can proclaim Christ. Whoops. So that's just a few examples of approaches you could take. All right. Any questions about Hinduism before we move on to Buddhism? You don't know what you were before. You might have been a murderer, a rapist, a robber. Or, you know what else you could... You know, it would be even more devastating than that. You might have been a Brahmin priest. And you're on the way down. You might have been way up here, almost to your goal, four lives ago. And you're three lives ago, you're here, then here, then here. Now you're here. Next thing you know, you might be way down there. You're going to be a bug before you know it. Yeah, there's no way they know what's coming. And they know, there's no way they can know for sure if they're going to have hope beyond the next life. Even this life is the only one they have control over now. So, okay. Yeah, pointing out the futility. I mean, and there's always a positive side. It doesn't always have to be negative. Instead of just pointing out the futility, you could point out the hope of Christianity. You could proclaim the kingdom of God. Do like Jesus and preach the kingdom. Just say, let me tell you about something that just fills me with excitement and hope. history is going somewhere. There's a purpose to all this. It's not a big cycle. It's all designed by this great God who created it all to move towards this final climactic, wonderful thing where He's going to set up this fantastic kingdom and rule it Himself. And there's all this, and we know for sure that we can be in this kingdom. And there's a way to know for sure that you'll rule in this kingdom. And you can know what your purpose is for existing. And you can know the God who made you and all this stuff. And proclaim the hope that's so devoid, that a reincarnation system is so devoid of.
I'm going to interject just a second. Part of their reincarnational thought process is based on self again. That they know that there's been better this lifetime or that. It's not just haphazardous, is what's being said here. They really believe that they're doing good, and they really believe that they were better than they were last time. So that's what. So they do have hope, but it's all in the self will.
Right. Right. Yeah, if you talk to someone, that's a good point. If you talk to somebody who believes in reincarnation, they're not going to assume that they're on their way down. They're going to assume that they're better and better, which then they have a tough time explaining. Well, how is it that some people are still so bad?
Because they just got born, they're new souls. So if we know.
Oh, they're new.
Yeah, they're new souls, and they're just on the way up. So that's how the Catholic can get started. They start out the Catholic because they're new souls. That's why they're just treated like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's okay. So that's a good correction. Deborah pointed out, you talk to these people, and by the way, this is good for you guys to correct me on some of this stuff, because I am not an expert on other religions. I spend my time studying the truth, and I don't know that much about all the errors, and so it's good to have some, if you have personal experience. So the person thinks that they're convinced they are on the way up, and that they are doing well, and this whole thing is working. But still, you can point out the frailty and the weakness of every human being knows that he has. And if the whole thing is dependent on me, that is not as hopeful as the whole thing being dependent on an almighty God who loves me. So still, you can address the issue of hope. Now, in the Hindu system, it's not the ultimate big picture of history is not one of hope. The thing does get worse. The whole system winds down and gets worse until Shiva ends up just destroying it all because it's so bad, and then Brahma recreates a whole new golden age, and it starts on top again until it's bad enough to be destroyed again. And that's how all of history just keeps going. It starts out good and goes bad and gets destroyed, and then starts restarts. So that ours is a more hopeful system than that, definitely, you know, at the big picture. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can't move out of your caste in one life. Yeah. Right. Right. Okay. Anything else on Hinduism? Okay. Buddhism. I put a timeline there on your notes. Is it in the outline? Buddhism? Okay. Now, these are approximate. This is the Ferguson's quick and easy Bible date method of remembering Bible dates. They're not exact numbers, but if you just think of Abraham being around 2,000, Moses being around 1,500, David around 1,000, and the end of the Old Testament around 500, and then Jesus around 0, then you can kind of think in increments 500. At least it's easier to remember. The writing of the Hindu scriptures, we said, was about between Moses and Christ there during 1,000 years. Then Buddha comes along right around the end of the Old Testament, around 500 BC. There was a man, let me tell you about the man. He was a prince, and his name was Siddhartha Gautama. And And Siddhartha Gautama's dad was a ruler of a petty kingdom. And Siddhartha Gautama lived a life of incredible luxury, legendary luxury. And he became known as the Buddha. Buddha means enlightened one. So he was just Siddhartha Gautama until he was sitting under a tree one day and became fully enlightened. And at that moment, he reached Buddhahood, which is nirvana. And that moment when he reached nirvana, he became the fully enlightened one, the Buddha. Now, Buddhism was branched off of Hinduism. It originated in India. He was a Hindu, and it's kind of a rebellion against certain aspects of Hinduism. Buddha opposed the idea of many gods. The polytheism of Hinduism, he opposed the caste system, the supernatural just in general, and the power of the Hindu priest class. He denied all that. And he challenged the authority of the Vedic scriptures and rejected most of the ritualism and the ritual worship. Buddhism spread into Central Asia and then into China and had a huge impact on China. And then Chinese forms of Buddhism went into Korea and Japan. And Buddhism became the chief religion in Japan for the next 1,000 years after that. Early in its history, Buddhism divided into two forms. Now, this is important because these forms are so different. There's the conservative group and the liberal group. Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism. Theravada is the conservative group. Mahayana is the liberal group. And they're very different. I'll talk about those in a minute, but they're just two separate, totally different religions. The thing about Buddha, the man, I don't know if you've ever been curious about him. We don't know that much about him because most of it's legend. No biography was written until centuries after he died. And he didn't write anything. So what happened in his life from the legend is this. He had this life of total luxury until age 29. And at age 29, he realized his life was empty and meaningless. And so he abandoned his wife and kids and his family, and he went wandering around and practiced yoga, trying to find the truth. And he turned to the monastic lifestyle, became a monk, and just turned to extreme asceticism and harsh treatment of his own body. And denied himself food and all kinds of things. According to him, the worst thing there is suffering. That's his assumption. He doesn't try and prove that. He just assumes that. The worst thing there is suffering. And so he really wasn't cut out for asceticism. If you don't like suffering, then that's just a bad way to go. And so he kind of bailed out on that. And after hitting a dead end with self-indulgence on one extreme and hitting a dead end on asceticism on the other extreme, he adopted what he called the middle path, which is nice. This is what makes Buddhism popular. You can salve your conscience and still not have to go to any extreme anywhere. So he says you find a middle path between asceticism and self-indulgence, and that's the true path. So he's sitting under a tree one day meditating, became totally enlightened, and that moment became the Buddha. And he went around preaching from then on. Now, he didn't write anything. Their sacred writings were written about 500 years later, after Gautama. And they're known as the Tripitaka or something like that. I don't know how to pronounce it. But it means the three baskets, and it's just three collections of writings. Now, let me summarize Buddha's beliefs. Basically, he taught the four noble truths, and this is the core of Buddhism. Number one, life is suffering by its very nature. Human existence is essentially painful, and there's no escape even at the moment of death. You just go into another rebirth, and it's just as painful. The cause of all suffering is ignorance of the nature of reality and grasping the grasping and the attachment that results from that ignorance. And suffering ought to be ended. and you can end suffering by overcoming your ignorance and attachment. And then the path to the suppression of suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path, which consists of right views, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindedness, right contemplation. In other words, you just do everything right, and you'll be just fine. Once you do everything right, then you reach Buddhahood, which is nirvana. He believes that man is an aggregate of a bunch of different factors, body, feelings, predispositions, things like that, and consciousness. And those things, five basic things, those things are dynamic. They're constantly changing. And so you're never the same person for two consecutive moments because you're just a conglomeration of these five factors that are always changing. And so he didn't believe there's such a thing as a soul that's you from moment to moment, from life to life. There's no enduring soul. There's no permanent soul. And so that's an important thing, is denying that. If you believe that you are a permanent soul, that you are a someone who's the same someone you were 5 minutes ago, believing that makes you want to continue to exist. And that desire to continue your existence is the cause of pain. And so the whole goal is to realize that there is no permanent soul. And then you won't have that desire to continue to exist, and then you can be free from the problem of pain. And that's why Buddhists make a distinction between rebirth and reincarnation. Reincarnation believes that it's the same soul going from life to life. Buddhism believes that you're different. You're actually a different person in the next life, just like you're a different person 5 minutes ago. Now, karma, these are just real brief. I just want to introduce you to these terms. The entire Buddhist system is based on the belief that there's perfect justice. And who was it that asked that question? Who decides? That's a great question, especially for a Buddhist. Now, Hindus believe that there are gods out there, but the Buddhist believes that there's perfect justice, but there's no God. Buddhism, according to what we believe, is basically atheistic. They don't believe in any God that's anything like what we would think of as God. And so there's no God that brings about justice. It just happens absolutely all by itself. The Buddhist has the exact same problem as the evolutionist here. He has to explain how all this can happen just without any intelligent being doing it. Human actions automatically lead to rebirth in which good deeds are rewarded and evil deeds are punished by being reborn at a higher or lower level with regard to species, beauty, intelligence, longevity, wealth, social status. You can come back as a human or as something else, an animal or a ghost or a denizen of hell or one of the Hindu gods even. There's never such a thing as undeserved pleasure or unwarranted suffering. Anybody who has anything is getting what they deserve. If you're ugly, you deserve to be ugly because of your last life. If you're rich, you deserve to be rich. You're getting just what you do. If you're a baby and you're being tortured and beaten by your parents, you're just getting exactly what you deserve. Now, obviously, that part is one of Buddha's less popular doctrines and rejected by most modern-day Buddhists. In fact, a lot of modern-day Buddhists go out of their way to do a lot of social service and be kind and help people who are down and out, things like that, because they want to distance themselves from this, which is good. But that's what Buddha believes.
Are they distancing themselves from that, or are they doing good to help them in that?
Well, some of them, people are different, but some of them actually want to distance themselves from this particular doctrine because it's just unpalatable in today's age, even though Buddha taught it.
So if I were a Buddha and my next-door neighbor was beating their child, would it be appropriate for me to ignore that and not interfere because that child was receiving its due karma?
That would be a good question to ask Gautama, because it seems to me that he went around preaching, helping people, even after he became Buddha. It seems to me that he was trying to relieve at least their spiritual deficiency, and if you take his doctrine to the logical extreme, what they already have is exactly what they deserve, and we shouldn't try to interfere. But he did interfere, so it seems to be a bit of a contradiction in the belief system.
They must believe that you
That's another contradiction in their belief system. If there's no eternal soul, why should I be responsible for whatever that guy in my last life was doing? That wasn't even me. And yet, I am. So, you're right. I mean, there's some sense in which, obviously, in their belief system, you've got the same being. Because otherwise, what do I care what my next life is going to be? It's not even going to be me. It's like caring about what your next life is. That's just as much me as it. So, there's some sense in which there is an identity. And yet, and again, when you're talking about this Eastern mysticism stuff, there's lots of contradictions, and a lot of stuff is meaningless. And there, you know, whatever answer they would have to that question, I'm sure would be completely devoid of any meaning. So, that's a good point, and that's one of the things you want to do is find contradictions in people's belief systems.
A lot of the things too, which is pulling away karma, is also one of the tools that are pulling away from any kind of pain and feeling of another person's emotions. So when he left his family, it was not only discover God, but to discover himself, and only through himself, and not feeling, not having the wives or whatever on his, in his case, or whatever, he just went into that nothingness.
Right. Yeah.
They called the Bible. So when you get enough into the nothingness, nobody's in your face,
right.
Then all of a sudden they're free. And that to them is, so karma, well, that's how they can just push them off. Well, then they deserved it.
Yeah.
So they don't have to feel it.
Right.
And as long as they're not feeling, they're not in touch with the soul, so they can forget that there's cause and effect by calling it karma.
Yeah, excellent.
And pushing themselves away from the whole routine.
Right.
So in embracing the karma, that's how they just push themselves away from any kind of personal heart pain.
Buddhism has to be absolutely the most self-focused religion there is. It's just completely focused on self.
I was just curious, but you know, and it says anyone who is intelligent has earned that in previous life. So is that part of the reason why it seems to be so popular among the wealthy and beautiful society?
Yeah, the higher your caste, or in Hinduism, or the more wealthy you are, and so on, and beautiful you are now, the more inclined you are to believe this. If you're at the bottom end of all that stuff, then you're gonna maybe question some of this stuff. Right. That's a Anatman is the name of the. I think the name of that doctrine is a very important doctrine. In you know, according to Gautama's teachings, it's crucial that you understand. There's no. That's the basis of ridding yourself of the desire to continue to exist.
What's their definition of
reincarnation? They don't. If you ask the Buddhists, they'll say, "I don't believe in reincarnation. I believe in rebirth." So, trying to pin them down on the difference. Yeah, there are some Hindus that say it can only be a human, but the Buddhism is you can be all kinds of different beings, even a god, which you're better off to be human than a god, and we'll get to that. But yeah, it's just it's really a problematic idea. The goal is just to, and it's an interesting concept to introduce to a Buddhist. Hey, maybe suffering isn't bad. You know, I don't even know if that idea ever even occurred to Gautama. That maybe suffering isn't bad. Maybe it's not always best to relieve suffering. Maybe there's some purpose. And then the other thing is, maybe the desire to continue to exist that we all have is a good thing. And maybe that's something that's worth pursuing. Okay, now, their belief in God, like I said, they're basically atheistic. Or Buddha was. They do believe in beings that they call gods, but there's absolutely zero continuity between the beings they refer to as gods and what we think of as a god. They're connected only by names. The gods live in heaven. Their lives are long and pleasurable. They have lots of pleasure. But they're in the same predicament as other creatures. They're eventually subject to death and further rebirth in lower states of existence if they don't watch it. And they're not creators of the universe. They don't control anything in human destiny. There's nothing that we need to concern ourselves in the slightest about them. And the problem with being a god is you enjoy so much pleasure that you forget your need for salvation. And you tend to become engrossed in a pleasure, and enlightenment isn't possible for you if you're a god. You can only reach enlightenment if you're a human being. So the best thing that can happen to you if you're God is for you to die and then be reborn as a human being. It's incredibly self-focused. The gods are just another species of being out there that have no significance for us. And if you, I talked to a missionary who is a missionary in Japan, who works with a lot of Buddhists there, and it's a little different form of Buddhism there, but they, he said it's so hard to preach the gospel to them because they don't even have a word in their vocabulary that can describe God. And if you use the word God, you'll totally throw them off. They'll think of something completely different. The way they think of the gods is, the gods are like this, these beings out in the spirit world. And if you think of them as like ravenous dogs, dangerous dogs, you're safe in your house. And if you open your front door, the goal, whenever you open your front door, is to keep any one of those dangerous dogs from slipping in to, and coming and biting you and tearing you to pieces. And so the spirit world, all their religious ceremonies they go through aren't to honor the gods in any way. It's just to keep them out of their lives. And from creating, because whenever they're around, they create problems, and so you just want to keep them away. And so to try and introduce, and he told me what set of words he came up with finally to describe to them the concept of a God like the God we believe in. It was brilliant. I just can't remember it. I tried to contact him, and I'm still waiting to hear back from him. But I'll let you know if he ever... Anyway, it's a very difficult thing to do for them, to communicate the concept of the true God to them. The Buddhist Church of America published a pamphlet that said patience and perseverance matter more than the blood of crucifixion, God sacrificing his own being on the cross. God is not a creator, does not judge or punish, is not transcendent, and is not a deity of fear and mercy. If you meet a Buddhist on a street and just start talking to him, he may or may not be trying for nirvana. Nirvana is so hard to reach that most don't even try. A lot of Buddhists are just content to just try for a better life next time around. Because they know, most of them know, that really to have any real shot at nirvana, you have to become a monk, and they're not into that. So, if you live differently, I mean, you will live differently depending on whether or not you're shooting for nirvana or shooting for just a better life. Reaching nirvana is so self-focused. You become a monk, you become a drain on society, you beg for food, you achieve enlightenment through cultivating various inner attitudes. What you do for society is of no consequence. To attain a better rebirth, though, that has to do with fulfilling your duties to society, which means avoiding five things: killing, stealing, harmful language, sexual misbehavior, and the use of intoxicants. And then you can get a better life. But if you want to really go for it all and reach nirvana, then it's not so much, it doesn't matter how kind you are or anything like that, or whether you have any virtue, really. It's just if you can attain enlightenment and reach nirvana. And the word nirvana means extinguishing, to become cool or blow out, like blowing out a candle, extinguishing a candle. In Hinduism, it's the only way to escape the cycle of reincarnation, to reach nirvana. But in Hinduism, nirvana practically has dropped out in modern times. It's a very minor point of the religion, and a lot of Hindus don't even pay any attention to the concept. In Buddhism, it's a huge deal, just like Vindhya pointed out last week. It's a major factor in Buddhism. It's the whole goal. And it can be reached before or after death. You don't have to wait until you die to reach nirvana. It's not like going to heaven. You can reach nirvana in this life while you're still here. So you might run into a Buddhist on the street who's already reached nirvana. All his passions, desires, and desires have been extinguished, and he's a Buddha. And if you try and define what is nirvana, there's basically no meaningful explanation of nirvana that's acceptable to most Buddhists, because nirvana can only be explained by nonsensical language. If you say anything that has any meaning or makes any sense, you'll say you're incorrect. So you just have to experience it. In theory, nirvana is attainable by any Buddhist, but realistically, it's only for the monks. Buddha was absolutely indifferent to the question of man's origin, refused to recognize any supernatural authority in the cosmos. Man is the center of the Buddhist universe, and only what he does matters. Heaven and hell are conditions of feeling and emotion, not locations. There's no end time scheme that's even suggested. No reason is offered for the reality of sin and death. They teach self-control, but not remission of sin.
What if their lifestyle, if you ask them, what if your lifestyle really is killing, stealing, harmful language, sexual misbehavior, and smoking, opiate? What would happen to that person?
They would just come back as a lower form. Come back as a bug or some hungry ghost. Yeah, see, that's the great thing. That's why this religion is so popular, because you might be tempted to get drunk some night and say, you know, it's worth it. I don't mind if I come back a little lower. You know? Oh, yeah. I wrote a... Yeah. Right. If they totally... Everything's self... Everything. There's no God. There's no authority. There's no... I mean, it's just... I sent an email to Jeff Hossamer, this guy that's in our best church, real funny guy, and I said, I'm trying to find out this missionary's email address, and I asked him, he didn't know, but he wrote back, I said, I'm researching Buddhism, so I need to talk to this guy, and he wrote back and he said, oh, let me know what you find out about Buddhism, because I've been looking for a religion that makes almost no demands and will still stab my conscience and allow me to sleep in on Sunday mornings, you know, so... I mean, that's a pretty good take on it. It's just that it has appeal because it makes so little demand. You know, it's the middle road. And whatever you feel like is right is fine. And it's you're not responsible. You're not guilty. It's, you know, somebody who's just into nihilism or they just want to indulge themselves, the problem they have is they have to deal with their conscience. Buddhism is a way that you can have a religion that doesn't infringe on your lifestyle too much, but it can, you can think through ways that you can stab your conscience. So let me talk real quick about the branches of Buddhism because they're so different. Theravada Buddhism means the way of the elders. It's basically what Gautama taught. All this stuff that I've been talking about. They're the conservatives and they believe that. And they believe that there's very few Buddhists. There's almost no Buddhists out there, really. Just a very, very few. And there's very few bodhisattvas. Now, a bodhisattva is somebody who's destined to reach Buddhahood but just hasn't done it. They're not Buddha. They're not in nirvana, but they're going to get there. They're destined to, and so they're a bodhisattva. Now, the other branch, the liberal branch of Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, it's called the Great Vehicle, and that's as opposed to Theravada, which is the lesser vehicle. Theravada Buddhists don't go along with that definition, but anyway, that's what that means. And they're just drastically different. Theravada Buddhism is atheistic. Mahayana Buddhism is just like Hinduism. It's polytheistic. And they worship. There's a lot of worship in the Mahayana Buddhism. They worship Buddha statues. They worship all kinds. They have all kinds of rituals. They believe there's lots and lots of Buddhism. Tons of people have reached nirvana. There's Buddhas all over the place. There's bodhisattvas all over the place. Because for them, reaching nirvana, you know, it's just like any liberal. Reaching nirvana is much, much easier. They make it so it's not so hard. They de-emphasize the traditional Buddhist scriptures. They have their own scriptures that are more authoritative. They're willing to pass on nirvana. They say, well, we'll just pass up that and just be willing to stay here and help people along their path. And that's what the bodhisattvas have done. Bodhisattvas have reached spiritual perfection, but they've decided not to enter nirvana because they're going to help the rest of us along. And then there's a couple other forms I can mention of Buddhism that branched off of Mahayana Buddhism. Zen Buddhism originated in China. Now it's practiced mostly in Japan. Zen Buddhism majors on emptying the mind. They're the ones that say you should spend an hour thinking about the sound of one hand clapping and things like that. Logic and reason are absolutely taboo, and the goal is to be nothing and think nothing and melt into nothing. The founder of Zen Buddhism is known for staring at a wall for 9 years. Um, And then there's you've heard of Tibetan Buddhism. That's a unique form of Buddhism and Hinduism, and they're known Tibetan Buddhism. They're known for their special priesthood called the lamas, and that's not the animal. It means superior ones. It's a priest. It means superior ones. The lamas are all reincarnations of the various bodhisattvas, and the supreme lama is the Dalai Lama, who's a reincarnation of one specific bodhisattva. All right. Now, Buddhism in the United States, the first Buddhist university was established in Boulder. Naropa. That's the first Buddhist university established in the United States. And it's extremely popular here. I went to a bookstore in Boulder the other day, and the section on Hinduism was one shelf, and the section on Buddhism was four times the size of that. It's big here. Many respected celebrities are Buddhists. Larry Hagman, Harrison Ford, Tina Turner, Richard Gere. A lot of people, it's interesting because a lot of people gravitate towards Buddhism because they think it's such a simple religion, but in reality, if they follow the actual Buddhism, it's very complex. It's hard to find a religion that's more complex. First, you have to follow the Four Noble Truths, then the Eightfold Path, then there's 37 precepts of the Eightfold Path, plus 55 obstacles that have to be overcome, three refuges for the monks, 227 regulations, four inner attitudes, and it goes on and on and on. But the great appeal of Buddhism is that since you're not answerable to God, you can choose whatever level of devotion you want. It's up to you. It's the middle way. And it's not too demanding on anything. But they have a moral code. So that saves your conscience, the fact that they have kind of a moral code. But if you break it, it's no problem because you can just make up for that later. And it's not uncommon to talk to a Buddhist and say that they chose that religion because it infringes the least on their lifestyle. So, that's as quick a summary as I can give for Buddhism. And I guess I've used up all the time again just describing that.
Which one's the most popular?
Mahayana is more popular than Theravada. The liberal is... Well, both Mahayana and Theravada are practiced in the U.S. Most of the time in the U.S., when you find a Buddhist, all bets are off. They might be 80% Buddhist and, you know, believe Jesus is God and who knows what else. You know, I mean, it's such a hodgepodge. In the United States, the people that are into Eastern mysticism in the United States, they just make such a cafeteria style out of their religion that they'll just take bits and pieces and throw out what they don't want. Because there's a mentality...